Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is May 23rd, 2023. And this is episode 379. You are listening to Radio Warnerd at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. I'm the co-host Mark Ames here in Rochester, New York. And I'm on the line with John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd in Puglia, Italia. How you doing, John?
Well, I'm doing better than I was. I'll do a typical Dolan detailed medical horror story soon. But first, I want to know about this reenactment, the Civil War thing.
Yeah, I was just telling John before we started, I went to a bit of a Civil War, Appreciation Day or something. So there's this, what's called the largest open living museum in New York State. And hold on, something was just delivered to me. Oh, as we speak, you can go ahead and keep recording. I just got, that's cool. I got the posters from Frank Kozik. Frank Kozik, who like did all these great sort of punk posters and album covers. And I saw through the Butthole Surfers, one of their feeds, that he had died. He's kind of a legend. He's originally from Spain or Barcelona, and then he moved when he was young to California, and he became this like kind of legendary. He's really good. I mean, he's great. And it was hard to find any of his books. I was only able to find one book of his that I got online. Good stuff. It's cool. Anyways. R.I.P. to Frank Kozik. So, anyway, this outdoor museum, it is called the Genesee Country Village and Museum. It's like about, I don't know, a half hour west of where we are in Rochester. And it's like, it uses authentic and reconstructed old sort of early and mid 19th century buildings, and people, you know, the people who work there dress up in full costume, and you know, they have like an apothecary and, you know, candy shop selling old candies, and you can play old games as they played back then. But this day was Civil War Day, and so I brought my two kids and my wife and my mother-in-law and one of my kids' friends, and it was cool. I mean, it was very cool. And I think the part that was kind of most interesting and most, well, two parts where one is they had an Abe Lincoln actor lookalike and a Frederick Douglass actor lookalike. And they actually,
looked like Abe Lincoln and Frederick Douglass?
Very much. Like you look on the $5 bill, I would show, you know, I was showing my son's friend just, you know, look at this and look at that. Or I was showing my three-year-old, like they couldn't believe it. Wow. They thought he literally walked off the $5 bill, and he spoke like him too. They did a great sort of routine, including parts. It had to do with what we talked about last episode, which was trying to overcome, you know, obstacles and what was in people's minds to raise, bring Black people, African Americans, into the USCT, the Union Army. USCT. Yeah. And it was great. And then the other part had to do with, so they went over some history of the 108th Regiment, the New York 108th Regiment, which was organized in Rochester in 1862. And on the monument to it, it has an shamrock, a three-leaf clover, a shamrock. So I don't know how Irish, I mean, the names that were called out weren't, but maybe they were commanders, weren't necessarily so Irish. I don't know how Irish Rochester was, because these days, like the last waves were more Italian, I think. But
I don't hear a lot about Rochester, although who was that guy who wrote Ironweed?
I know, I was thinking about that too. God, I want to say Quinn, but that's the hero in Ironweed.
Yeah.
Which was... which was named...
That reminded me more of My Mother's Family than any other book.
Wasn't that more Albany?
Yeah, it was Albany. Yeah,
Albany,
right.
Yeah.
All upstate New York is... Because New York is shaped like a fan, you know? Everything fans out from the city, and it's like, it's somewhere up there. I don't know. It's like you have to draw a different radius yes. from the center of the triangle, and they diverge very widely.
Well, I got to say, when you get out, I mean, it really is two states. It's sort of New York City and Long Island, and then that massive fan that you talk about, and it's it is easy to mistake them. I mean, it's a large state, but you know, the cities, Rochester, Buffalo, Albany, they all have a similar kind of feel to them. So
my mother had a fierce family loyalty, and that both sides did, and kind of a tragic one. I never knew quite why it was tragic, but it just was. And so we always had to make the drive up to Cortland. And I never quite knew where Cortland was, but we visited because my Uncle Billy was a state trooper. I think you have to say it without the R at the end, you know, a state trooper. And he wore those World War One hats, which struck me as truly bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, the state troopers do that. Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ironweed
and
is William
Cortland
Kennedy.
Was a long way.
Yeah, it is. Well, Cortland is, if I'm not mistaken, we passed through it between Syracuse and like Binghamton. So basically past Syracuse on your way to New York City if you're driving there.
So did these guys do a battle or did they just walk around being Civil War-y?
So they showed, they had actual, well, I don't know if they were replicas or actual, or, but they had the Springfield, you know, muskets or rifles, right? Mm. And then they showed that you load in the, you know, the gunpowder. And then, of course, you don't put in a bullet. but then you put the cap in the, put the cartridge in, and then you fire it. It makes a pretty loud sound, but nothing obviously comes out. Mm. And they were demonstrating that. And then they had all the kids do drilling. So it would be like you're going on your first day of drilling. And so I sent my kids out there. And
wow.
And I thought it looked really fun. You know, you had to do, you know, right hut and this kind of stuff, and then marching around, and you had to understand file, you know, what it means to file and or to sort of line up and file like in fours and then in twos, and why you were in twos because of loading the gun. Sammy, my oldest, he thought it was okay. He actually liked the Lincoln Douglas debate, which kind of surprised me. He was really into it. I thought he was going to complain. Whereas the marching and all the drilling stuff, he didn't like it because it was too, basically it was too cramped. Like people are just too, you know, he's kind of like Francis. Any of you guys touch me, I'll kill you. whereas Jerry seemed to think it was pretty cool. And then they demonstrated shooting again. So and then they talked a bit about the 108th, and it's a pretty horrible story. They gathered up, you know, 300, 1862. Were they drafting yet? I don't know if they were drafting, if they were drafted or volunteers.
Well, the draft rights were 1863. So I don't think they started a draft until 1863.
That's what I think, too. So yeah.
And 1862 was bad news for Union forces almost everywhere. So, you know, not good for recruiting.
No. So they gather them in the hot summer. They basically drilled as they marched from Rochester all the way to Albany. Then, they didn't really say. And then they went down to Baltimore. And then from Baltimore, I think they marched to Washington, D.C., and then they did some more drilling and preparing and learning, you know, to fire the muskets and all that stuff, or the guns. And then they marched straight up to the Battle of Antietam, and literally the 108th Regiment, he described how the very first time they saw battle, they come up over this hill in the Battle of Antietam. Now, I can't remember which hill it was. And as they are coming up over the hill, the commander is up front. He was buried there. His head's blown off immediately. And within about 10 to 15 minutes, 150 of the 300 were casualties. Yeah. 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, a lot of battles did that for particular units. That was it. They just formed the front rank and they were shredded.
Yeah.
Because you had to maintain formation. Sometimes an officer would have sense enough to let you lie down. It was officially the job of the officers, mostly captain to colonel rank, regimental rank, to pace around on their feet and stay on their feet while the troops lay down, because there was just a moving rain of flesh shredders in the air. And that was when they earned their pay, as some officers said, because the men got to lay down if the officer had any sense, which they didn't always. Yeah. And the officer would stand and then say, "Stand!" And, you know, that was when the enemy got an unpleasant sight, which was that field of corn actually was field of soldiers. And then fire, and then and a good time was had by all. But you know, they weren't always allowed to lie down. People, especially like in France, as Céline describes, in the early years of the war, there was a lot of elan, and it cost a lot of lives. Like, you know, you're gonna stand there and get shredded.
Yeah. Yeah, and this was their first battle. I mean, can you imagine, your first battle is the bloodiest battle in U.S. history? Like, you come up over a hill. Yeah. They were 50 yards from the Confederates. Like, they didn't know what they were coming up against. And, you know, your first thoughts in your head are all about proving yourself. You don't have any war experience yet. So they were wiped out, but they were reconstituted several times, and they fought in all the big battles, 108th. You know, just with constantly getting new recruits throughout the war.
They used to call your first battle "seeing the elephant." Like, have you seen the elephant? And that, because it was like, I guess elephants were like the most amazing sight most people in small towns saw.
That's right.
And I think the figure of speech was meant to imply you can't imagine it till you see it.
Right. Yeah, so anyway, to wrap that up, one of the great things about two days ago, this sort of Civil War Appreciation Day was, it was just all about appreciating the Union sacrifices, and that's what they were emphasizing. There was no, you know, it was brothers, it was tragedy, none of this, you know, Confederacy, both sides is bullshit. It was a very Northern, very Union, and only Union. There were African Americans who were like history nerds, you know, dressed up in uniform as well, and they were given talks in different areas. I mean, it was like there were like 20 or 30 stations you could go to get different aspects of the period or of the war, different people. Some guys would talk about, you know, the railroad. Some would talk about medicine. So it was cool.
On a pedantic note, what did the reenactor types look like? Because, and this also applies to the Lincoln guy, one of the problems with reenacting the Civil War is that they were all emaciated compared to contemporary people, and they have to diet pretty strenuously to look like Civil War people. So did they?
So the Lincoln guy had actual sunken cheekbones and was tall. And I took some photos. I'll send them to you. It was incredible. Yeah. The main Civil War, kind of the leader of the group and the one who ran the drills and stuff, he both fit in as he could have passed for a Civil War guy. He was pretty thin. He had kind of dark and hollowness underneath the eyes. He had a mustache, but not a cool mustache. But with a little work, he probably could have passed for, you know, a bourbon sipping hipster too, I guess. But he was pedantic about the clothes too. I was talking to him about the clothes.
Wool coats. I bet it was hot.
But they had, he explained how the wool worked, because the wool gets wet. So they had sort of thinner wool for the summer, the hotter times. And it's hot, but it's durable. And when it gets wet from sweating, it cools you down because it stays wet. And then they had wool overcoats. They had there. He also showed like sort of the original uniform, which was a kind of a wool. It looked nice for the photos. Wool coat with a whole bunch of buttons down the middle. I mean, it was more like kind of the jacket before they had the overcoat. And he said it was so unwieldy and, you know, just kind of impractical on the battlefield that soldiers started improvising, like sewing pockets on the inside. And so then the, you know, the army itself started remaking what was standard uniforms. So following along with what the soldiers were already doing. And he said the Confederates, it was kind of interesting as, you know, the Confederates are kind of notoriously ragged and dirty. And he said, well, actually their uniforms were very high quality. They would use sort of a mixture of cotton and wool, and they actually were able to, and they got a lot of it from England. You know, damn John Bull. There's John Bull again, you know, always out to undermine us. But the problem was, had to do with sort of getting the uniforms to the soldiers and what was a priority for sort of the elites versus what, you know, what the rabble were could actually wear. So they went around in rags a lot, really, even though they didn't have to, because the Confederacy refused to invest in logistics, you know, refused to raise the money to invest in logistics, because that would mean taxing your precious properties, and they weren't going to do that.
No, if people want to read about this, there's a memoir by this pretty obnoxious ex-Confederate. It's called Company H, and at one point, after the disastrous campaign in Tennessee, they have to fall back on. I have to explain something, but they had to fall back under Braxton Bragg's leadership so rapidly that they came up with Bragg's supply depots, and they'd been starving on the lines, supposedly besieging a Union army, which was actually much better fed and supplied than they were, because the Union quickly learned you got to sort of care at least a little about how your soldiers are being fed, clothed, etc. And these Confederates, who were hardcore Confederates, kind of nasty people, in fact, they were totally disgusted to find that while they'd been trying to make, you know, millimeter thick pancakes out of what little dough they had left, these storehouses were crammed with overcoats, hams, like hams that weighed 30 pounds, and all the meat, all the grain you could possibly want. And by the way, people who marched all the time found that they needed grains. They needed carbs, basically. Because at one point, Sherman boasted that he could feed his men solely on the livestock of Georgia. And one of them said, I'd like to see him try it, because it was a kind of keto diet, and it's great for losing weight, but that wasn't exactly their problem. Bragg was exemplifying it more intensely than anybody else, but the Confederate armies in general just felt that it was the soldiers' job to suffer. I mean, Stonewall Jackson shot people who fell by the waysides on his foot cavalry marches. They're scary people. But sorry, what you might have witnessed just then is my hesitation in what should be a very familiar name, and one that I would really instantly get most of the time. And that's been happening to me an awful lot, and it scared the hell out of me. Like, what is this, premature senility? I mean, the Dolan Family Olympics, we weren't good at sports or anything, but by God, we could remember things. And it was a competitive event pretty much every evening with my two brothers and me and my father. So it was very scary to me to find that I couldn't remember names. And I realized eventually that this is part of the fact that I've got anemia again, pernicious anemia. Among the symptoms are a loss of memory, loss of breath, all kinds of really weird stuff. And unfortunately, you can't get B12 injections over the counter anymore. You used to be able to do that in Italy, but now it's prescription. I'm sure it's related to some drug law nonsense. And so no B12 until I finally overcame my very intense fear of doctors and saw one and got a prescription. And it was like one of those medical scenes in movies where something miraculous happens. Somebody gets an injection and life is transformed. So I can begin to remember things now, but if anyone notices that I'm kind of hesitant and slow in remembering things, like Braxton Bragg, to my shame, that's because basically there's no oxygen in my bloodstream right now, and it's just starting to feed back in.
Yeah. So not quite as dramatic, but on the spectrum with that shot of adrenaline, I guess it is, that in Pulp Fiction, that, you know, right in the chest, dunk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was a beautiful scene.
It was, yeah. I know. It's like, then you can go right back to doing your drugs again. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, almost like Ash with a similar scene. I live again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you got, I'm glad it was that simple, because, you know, when you're feeling like that, you have a whole lot of scary stuff comes into your head. And I got to admit, when you sent me that email, it's called like
megaloblastic anemia.
Megaloblastic. Yeah. I mean, my first thought was that you had sent something in the header that said like metaglioblastoma. I was like, holy fuck. There's a glioblastoma, but even worse because, you know, the brain cancer, the brain tumor. But thank God it wasn't that.
So far not.
Yeah.
No doubt that will reveal itself with some gaudy symptoms one of these days. I'll take up Rosicrucianism or something.
Yeah. So what else was I going to say? Yeah, I'll maybe report about this in a little bit more in the future, but I was at the local Barnes & Noble and got for my kids for one day this book. It looked great. It had a great sort of cartoonish cover. It's the U.S. Civil War, and the book promised to be none of the boring stuff, just straight to the battles. You know, nobody wants this boring stuff, and this is for kids and stuff. And I thought, oh, great. And I think if I remember right on the cover, it seemed very, you know, Union-oriented and not any of this this other crap.
I think
that
orientation is more common now. It's more acceptable.
Well, so I open up to the introduction, and on page 2, he talks about, you know, the Northern War of Aggression between the states or something like
good
that.
God.
And I was like, and I closed it. And so I don't know. I'm now kind of, I'm going to look at it again from a different perspective. I'm not sure I'm going to want to read this version to my kids. I don't know how the hell it gets into Barnes & Noble like that, but I'm going to be writing to them if it's what I think it is, you know.
Well, there is a big market for pro-Confederate stuff. And if you look at Amazon, it's really interesting to look at it's always interesting to look at comments, as I've said again and again, but on Civil War books, because there's usually somebody from South Carolina who bitterly disputes every single thing and has spent a tremendous amount of their lives assembling the so-called facts on their side. And strangely enough, these things are still being published, mostly by the University of South Carolina. I was looking for biographies of the governor of South Carolina, Wade Hampton III, actually. And it was actually a hero-worshipping biography. And I thought, you can't do this, sir. Wade Hampton and his proto-fascist red shirt movement basically pulled South Carolina back into truly vicious racist segregation and ended any hope of changing the lives of the freed people. But that stuff does get around. And I think mostly because, as we've said before, the North just assumes we won. Yeah, that's that. But the South, very, very serious about it. Certain population groups in the South, not everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right. So today we wanted to talk about the latest in war news. And I guess it's been, you know, at least in the Ukraine-Russia war, it's been a bit more eventful in the last few days. Otherwise,
yeah, it's been eventful on the ground and in the blogosphere.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing, of course, is that Russia, after, 9 or 10 months, or 11 months maybe, took Bakhmut a couple of days ago. Prigozhin formally sort of announced and made sure he was filmed announcing this, like at a well-known, landmark in Bakhmut, in the very, very western point of Bakhmut, that they had taken Bakhmut. And it was a long, very bloody battle. I mean, certainly the bloodiest battle and longest battle in Europe, since World War II, I would imagine. But we don't know how many people were killed. That's, or how many casualties there were. We know it was bloody. We know there were a lot of casualties. And I think the U.S., I mean, I've seen numbers thrown around. And it's just hard to trust them, both because numbers are propaganda and because, you don't know until everything's over and someday the record books are open. But I think the U.S. has estimated, I've seen these numbers thrown around anyway, that Russian casualties were a total of 100,000 just in the Battle of Bakhmut, and that Wagner casualties alone were 50,000. That is killed and wounded and missing.
That is massive.
Massive, I know.
How big is Wagner now?
So Wagner, I mean, that's another big question. And of course, you even have to believe Prigozhin. I saw Prigozhin, he said within the last day or two, he said he gets 10,000 new recruits a month. Now, this is possible. And he hasn't been recruiting, as far as I know, as far as we know, from prisons lately. But he definitely was for this battle and definitely recruited tens of thousands of prisoners for it. And a lot of them definitely died. But again, we don't know the numbers and we don't know the Ukrainian numbers, but you've been able to glean through some articles in the Western press that it has been very bloody and very deadly. And, you remember a few months ago, Western analysts and in media and think tank land, military politics were really trying to push Zelensky to just pull back and give it up, because it wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. And Zelensky and his military command, again, who actually controls the place? It's who is the power behind Zelensky? Well, it's military people. I mean, you can assume it's, the Siloviki there. Budanov, the head of the military intelligence, Reznikov, Zaluzhny, the head of the military. So, he said back in, so he gave an interview, Zelensky did, in late March, so just 2 months ago, where he was being asked about this again. Why won't you just, regroup, retreat, do a sort of strategic withdrawal? And he said, if Bakhmut fell, Putin, quote, would sell this victory to the West, to his society, to China, to Iran. If he will feel some, he said this in English too, if he will feel some blood, smell that we are weak, he will push, 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 Zelensky said. And, it was hard to understand. It was like, was he doing a feint? Was this propaganda? I mean, I think we gotta stick to the surface more, or trust but verify, I guess, the surface more than maybe we've given credit for. I mean, it's pretty clear the Ukrainians poured a lot into holding Bakhmut.
Is there any word on Ukrainian casualties?
No word that I've been able to see, but what I would say is this. when you look back last summer, a year ago, at the battles, the largest battles were, I mean, aside from the initial invasion and then pulling back, the largest pitched battles were the battles for Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, which are also in the Donetsk region. We talked about them a lot last year. And what really happened in those battles was, and we talked about this, I believe, at the time as well, was that the Russians were throwing a lot into those battles. And the Ukrainians poured a lot of people into it, but they did not put their best people into it. There were a lot of stories that were starting to come out towards the end about basically territorials, you know, glorified like weekend warriors, you know.
Yeah, they were just serving them up to the Russians while retaining their regulars.
Exactly. For the counteroffensive.
Yeah.
And that was smart. I mean, it was brutal, but it was a smart logic because the Russians had no juice after that. I mean, they had sort of expended themselves, both from the, you know, disaster of the first couple of weeks of the invasion, and then they tried regrouping, and then they spent a lot of men and material getting Lysychansk, Popasna, Lysychansk, and Severodonetsk. And then the Ukrainian counteroffensive started in the south. And it was bloody, and it didn't go anywhere for the first, so throughout August. But what it did was it thinned out already very thin Russian lines, and the Russians had been battered so much trying to take those two big cities, so that an opening came up, and the Ukrainians were able to take advantage of it, where they were able to take the whole Kharkiv region and Izyum and all these really important cities up north, and you know, with better with freshly trained troops and freshly armed troops with the new equipment from the West. And the Russians were very depleted, and that forced Putin to then mobilize, which, you know, I remember like Michael Kaufman kept saying, there's no way he's going to mobilize. Like he can't do it, and he won't do it for political reasons. And he did. He surprised everyone and did mobilization and survived it politically. And he put in Surovikin, so-called General Armageddon. Surovikin then ordered basically a withdrawal from Kherson and that side of the Dnipro. So they shortened the lines. And Surovikin basically prepared for a defensive war. Then Putin, earlier this year, you know, basically demoted Surovikin again. He was the only real commander who was, you know, which you would say competent. I mean, he was competent. Mm-hmm. He did his job right. Dealing with a disastrous invasion.
Well, it sounds like he didn't live up to his nickname in Putin's mind. Like,
I think that's the nickname in Westerners' mind. He came there,
so it's not a real one. Okay.
He came there and accurately and coldly assessed a really bad and disastrous situation and said, you know, we're going to have to give up this. We're going to have to, you know, retrench. And Putin agreed, let him do it, and then demoted him as soon as everything was stabilized again by December, January. And basically the Ukrainians had run out of juice after all the territorial gains they made, and they were massive in the fall. They ran out of juice and they couldn't take anything anymore. Then Putin reappointed Gerasimov, the famous Gerasimov doctrine, which was this invention by Western hacks that, you know, hybrid warfare and all this. Anyway, General Gerasimov, who's a pretty clearly poor commander, Putin put him back in charge for another offensive. And, you know, they didn't really get too much. I mean, so they took Soledar. But Bakhmut was the real battle. And if you want to look again at just hard, cold logic, you know, it makes a hard, cold sense to, if you're going to take this city, Bakhmut, where the Ukrainians have decided to put up a real hard defense to, you know, sort of as a matter of national pride for political reasons, for morale reasons, it kind of played into Russia's hands. I'm not saying Russia's doing, I don't see what huge advantage they've gotten, but they've clearly come out better from this than the Ukrainians, because look, the Russians killed off a bunch of prisoners who did not contribute to the Russian economy and were not the highly trained soldiers that, I mean, Russia keeps, they need to save their better trained soldiers and their mobilized soldiers for that matter for the counteroffensive and to hold on to what they have. So whereas Ukraine in this battle did use, I mean, again, I'm just gleaning this from bits and pieces because the Western media won't really report on anything that they think will make Ukraine look too bad. But for example, you know, a couple months ago, one of the most famous commanders, Dmytro Kutsubaylo, who goes by the nickname Da Vinci, he was killed in Bakhmut. There was a big sort of state funeral for him. Even the Finland's president came to it, which is, I got to say, pretty damn weird because he's a straight up fascist who openly worships, you know, the World War II Nazi collaborators and a good fighter too. And he had sort of famously said he kept a wolf in a cage and that was his unit's, this is the right sector guy. His unit's mascot was an actual wolf and there were bones in there. And a New York Times journalist asked, you know, what were those bones of? And he said, Russian children, that's what we feed them. And, you know, then everyone tried to explain, oh no, but that's just a joke. Ha ha. You know, what a lovely joke. Yeah. I mean,
might not be a joke anyway.
I know exactly. You know, again, I've said many times, like, why do the Ukrainians use so many of these kind of Nazi adjacent or actual neo-Nazis? Because they fight. They fight and kill, and they are ideologically wound up. I mean, why did, you know, NATO, the U.S., rely on al-Qaeda fighters in Syria so much? Because they fight better than the guys who like going to conferences. So, you know, he was killed there. I mean, just a few days ago, a couple of days ago, a senior commander, or no, a sergeant, okay, a commander from the Azov regiment, Shargorodsky, and he, you know, warranted a big article in the New York Times, was killed also just outside Bakhmut. Azov is an elite unit, you know, Da Vinci's right sector guys, these are elite units. They're the ones used for, you know, for really important work, for important battles.
Yeah, but I haven't followed this as well as you have, but I thought Azov was more or less wiped out in Mariupol.
No, okay, you know, think about how Prigozhin said he's now been able to recruit 10,000 a month. That might be true because of all the... Yeah. If you remember Seth Harp for Harper's and Rolling Stone, when he was on... He was actually interviewing Andrei Beletsky. Beletsky, who was an actual Russian neo-Nazi who came to Ukraine in 2014 because of Putin's crackdown on neo-Nazis. And he became sort of the Azov's founder, co-founder. And Beletsky, when Seth interviewed him, he wasn't like officially part of Azov, but his phone was constantly ringing. His Starlink Elon Musk phone was constantly ringing. He said, I've never had greater recruitment than since Mariupol started. They're all heroes. And so Azov is now not battalion, but regiment, you know, and probably several regiments. And they have no shortage of recruits. And So, but they are still, you know, considered elite units. And Kraken, which is another kind of fascist, quasi-Nazi adjacent. There are a lot of these groups. And the ideological training, you know, gets them in their minds that they are killers and they're invincible. And
one thing you've mentioned several times that I think people need to know is that there was kind of an ideological drive in the years before the war to promote not just Ukrainian identity, but a kind of belligerent stance and a paranoia connected to the Ukrainian sensibility, right?
Yeah. And it was never like there's been an argument about this because, I mean, look, let's just call it fascist. It's very fascist, very 30s, rooted in actual 30s and 40s fascist, Ukrainian fascists. And I mean, it was, it was useful because these were the guys who were the tip of the spear for the Maidan coup. I mean, it was a coup. It was a, you know, large scale coup, but it was a coup that overthrew a democratically elected, highly corrupt president, Yanukovych. These were the guys who were willing to do the violence. And then after Yanukovych fled and this new government came into power with a whole bunch of ministers for the first couple months until they had elections, a whole bunch of ministers from the extreme right Svoboda Party, which started out as the Social National Party and then changed to the Svoboda Party. You know, then there were these sort of rebellions in the Russian-speaking parts of the Donbass and south, Mariupol, in these areas. And they tried sending in regular army units, and so Russians would sort of lay down in front of the tanks. The regular units, the you know, draftees wouldn't run over Russians, didn't want to kill them because they saw them as, well, they were Ukrainians who were more Russian-speaking and didn't like the new government, which was very, like, ethno-nationalist. And so they organized all these so-called volunteer battalions, which were really kind of Nazi-tattooed, you know, Nazi skinhead music guys, people from prisons, people who worked as muscle for various oligarchs in takeovers, and they organized them into battalions like Azov, like Right Sector, like Aidar, Dnipro One, and so on. And these were the people who were more than happy to go in anywhere and kill Russians, which is who they saw as a pestilence. And so they've been very active since 2014. And Putin used that as an excuse for the invasion in 2022. And he said, we're going to go in and denazify. And what does he do? So he takes Mariupol, which was the Azov's, you know, stronghold then. So they've since metastasized everywhere because they got so popular after the Mariupol battles. They became heroes in Ukraine. And Russia wound up taking, you know, thousands of Azovtsi prisoners. And what does Putin do? He winds up trading hundreds of them. Supposedly this war is all about fighting Nazism. He trades hundreds of them, including like the biggest names, to get his buddy, his billionaire buddy Medvedchuk out of a holding cell in Ukraine. Ukraine held this one guy who's an old friend of Putin's, who supposedly maybe was a godfather to one of Putin's daughters, who knows, or Putin was a godfather to one of his kids. But it showed how much Putin really cared about the whole Nazi
thing. Yeah.
You know, you don't hear a lot about the denazification, actually, not nearly as much from the Russian side. It's more about fighting NATO now.
Yeah.
Even though the sort of the Azov and all that stuff is really, it really has metastasized a lot. But they don't really talk about it really since freeing hundreds and hundreds of these Azov, you know, bona fide Nazi lovers.
Well, I mean, I've been reading up on 20th century Turkish state history. And one of the clearest lessons of that story is that any degree of fascism can be ignored as long as it's seen as part of an alliance, which is seen in turn as an apocalyptic confrontation with what was then the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. But that's why I think this is a long tradition.
Yes,
I
mean, absolutely. It's a whole World War II, I mean, post-World War II, Cold War tradition, particularly with Ukrainian fascists and so on. But yeah, it's just, I think the one thing that strikes people as frustrating, myself included, is that in the Trump era, you know, suddenly like millions of people became even well-funded, you know, experts on extremism, experts on Nazism. They're Nazi hunting everywhere. Anybody who could be linked by 8 degrees to somebody who might be a bad guy was outed and attacked as a Nazi. And here you have us, like, so yesterday, you know, there was this incursion by Russian neo-Nazis armed up and trained by the Ukrainian GUR who invaded, you know, some villages on the border inside Russia, yesterday in the Belgorod region. And like everybody agrees, even Bellingcat, the leaders of the Russian Volunteer Corps, these are some of the biggest names, like people who made it their job, their business to sort of follow and track the extreme right and neo-Nazis, know these people. They know the leader of the Russian Volunteer Corps, Denise White Rex Nikitin. They're all mixed up in like sort of the neo-Nazi skinhead music scene and the clothing scene and the record store scene. They're all moving in and out of Azov Battalion. And, you know, here they are. They're invading Russia and killing border post people. And they're riding in on American armored vehicles that were given by NATO. And in fact, that was even in one of Jack Teixeira's, you know, one of the leaks from Jack Teixeira's famous leaks was that Zelensky or the Ukrainians were planning exactly an operation like this with NATO equipment. And they did it. And these guys are just straight up. I mean, there's a guy, Alexei Levkin, I think his name is. He's known to all that world as the head of Alexei Levkin, yeah, as the head of the Votenjugend, which is this big time neo-Nazi group that is very notorious. Everybody who's in that sort of research world knows about this Votenjugend, and they had translated the Christchurch, you know, murder neo-Nazi guy's manifesto into Russian Ukrainian. And they but they're in Ukraine. They're Russians who had to leave Russia because of Putin's crackdown on neo-Nazis. There were a lot of neo-Nazis in Russia. There was a big crackdown, waves of them by the Kremlin. And they went to Ukraine and they found safe haven there after the Maidan, you know, revolution coup in 2014. And then they were repurposed immediately to fight the separatists. And they happily did it, because they hate Putin and they hate the Kremlin. And this kind of tweaks people's brains because, well, wait, but isn't Putin the, you know, I think Hillary called him the leader of the global alt-right Comintern or something like that. And, you know, it's not like, I mean, that's the thing about this war. It's two right-wing states, you know?
Yes.
Two right-wing states fighting each other. People, like, people want to pick a side. It's, you don't have to pick a side on in this war. It's a pretty awful war with two, you know, there's a bad, just as you said, just because there's a bad guy doesn't mean there has to be a good guy. I mean, Ukraine has the right to defend itself, but I'm not excited for them, you know, when they go around using all these far right people in a country that, you know, has a history of massacring Jews. And it's I can't get emotionally deeply excited for their cause. I'm against this war, period, you know?
What I've seen in the Turkish context is very, very similar. I mean, there's basically a NATO override, and it affects both official circles in Europe and in the United States. And that was a little bit of a shock to me. I thought European circles would have been a little stricter about the Grey Wolves, which are in fact a fascist paramilitary group dedicated to basically killing everyone who dissents from the notion that Turkey, as now constituted, is a monoethnic state and no other religion than Sunni Islam, no other ethnic group other than Turkish, no other language other than Turkish has any right to exist. And if it does, the problem should be solved by killing them. I mean, this is a group that is very effective. And I find when I study this in multiple contexts, the same frustration that you mentioned, that there are a lot of people who are very brave about the two or three skinheads who probably got held back in fifth grade and are just fucked up people from the beginning in towns that they recognize. But they don't seem to want to go after the Grey Wolves.
Yeah.
They don't seem to want to go after the right sector in Ukraine. Yeah. If you want to fight Nazis, there's the real thing. And Nazis are quite capable of fighting back and killing you. But it's not as much fun as, you know, those two sad weirdos in your town.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I mean, this is also related to kind of a story. If you remember a couple of years ago, when Lukashenko and Belarus forced down this airliner flying from Greece to Lithuania in order to pull off this guy, Roman Protasevich, I believe his name was. Do you remember that story at all? And it turned out he
vaguely.
Was a Nazi.
Something about he gave up his girlfriend or something.
And then it turned. So when this happened, the EU went ballistic, and the US and NATO, you know, my God, this is, you know, an unprecedented act of hijacking, piracy. I mean, I don't want to get into the backstory because we've talked about it before, but Lukashenko clearly got the idea from Wagnergate Wagnergate when the Ukrainian secret services were planning to bring, they brought in all these Wagner guys on a fake sort of invitation to Minsk, and then they were going to fly him supposedly to Turkey, but over Ukrainian airspace, then force the airliner down. This was all just right on the eve of that election and the big protest in Belarus. And Lukashenko initially thought that Russia was trying to do a coup. And then he found out what actually happened, which is the Ukrainians planned to hijack a flight, a charter jet from Minsk to Turkey, and bring it down, and then put all these Wagner mercenaries on trial for human rights crimes. And I mean, it's pretty clear it influenced him. So he did that to Roman Protasevich. And this guy was, you know, a big opposition activist. He helped co-found NECTA. It looks like NECTA, if you've seen it online, which is a big opposition, Belarusian opposition social media site, very inflammatory. And it turns out, so he was downed. He was arrested. Everyone freaked out. Sanctions. I mean, pre-war, it was one of the biggest sort of European freakouts I'd seen in a few years. And very quickly, some people kind of knew that world, looked him up and realized this guy was the Azov Battalion. Not only was the Azov Battalion, but he was on the cover of Azov's magazine with the Black Sun and very proudly showing off, you know, all armed and talking about, and then people found him talking about how he killed Russians and, you know, he's fighting for Ukraine. He plans to bring that to Belarus. So this is a Nazi. I remember on social media when this came out, a lot of people got so angry that you would talk about it. Like, not now. Don't bring it up now. I remember this historian from Johns Hopkins saying, yeah, it might be true, but now is not the time to talk about it. So what does he do? He winds up, he had been arrested with his Russian girlfriend, who was an opposition activist in Russia. And it was his fiance, actually. And, you know, he folded very quickly. And he's a Nazi. Yep. He folded. He gave her up. He ratted her out. She's much worse off than he is now. She's still rotting in jail in Belarus. He kissed Lukashenko's ass publicly. I mean, granted, they might have pulled out some fingernails. You know, I'm sure they beat him up pretty hard. But like, you know, when you get into that business, I don't know. You gotta be a martyr. Otherwise, what the hell are you doing? He's not. He was just granted.
I mean, to be a Nazi is bad enough, but a Nazi and a wimp.
Oh, yeah, man. Exactly. And a turncoat, turning in your fiance. Yeah. And, you know, and he's now a propagandist for Lukashenko. And he goes on TV just propagandizing for him. So, yeah, you should have talked about how he's a Nazi right away. You actually could have, like, blunted the effects of Lukashenko turning him into his own propaganda, tool.
The similarities to Turkey, which is, as we are always told, a very important NATO ally.
Have been going on.
Yeah, it is. But it's the cornerstone or whatever architectural metaphor you want to use for it for NATO. But that means that the U.S. government and most of the NATO governments have covered up a century of massacres, genuine massacres on a large scale. Like even in the late 70s and 80s, there were massacres of Alevi Kurd intellectuals, mostly women. There's a particular hatred among the Grey Wolves for leftist women, especially when they're Kurds. And I wrote about this in one of the Warner newsletters, number 99, which was called The Fascists Nobody Wants to Talk About. They basically killed everybody they could find in a mass meeting of Kurdish Alevi groups in eastern Turkey. And with the police chief of the town was in full agreement with this, participated, and was praised for it, got a cabinet post later on. This was a massive fascist pogrom carried out by real live fascists who are, are not, dismal cast-offs, but really high-powered servants of the state and who were rewarded for it. One of them ended up in Erdogan's cabinet a little later. And there's just this weird silence about it.
It's infuriating, and the thing is when you're, this is one of the things about social media is you can respond to it and talk about it with other people, and other people who think something's not right here can also, this is why part of, one of many sort of little drops in the bucket of why people, I think more so now, have lost trust and faith in these, sort of establishment media. Because they do this. So like even, I noted when this same group, the Russian Volunteer Corps, did its first incursion into the Belgorod region. It was March 2nd or 3rd. So it was, 2 months ago. And the New York Times article on it could not say the word. And again, this guy, I'm not getting this from Russian, pro-Kremlin sources. This is from Western sources who just research these people. These are very anti-Putin people. That the head of the Russian Volunteer Corps and their symbols, everything about them is clearly like classic skinhead neo-Nazi stuff. This isn't even, we like Konovalets and Bandera. This is Hitler loving, this is straight to the top. And the New York Times could not describe them as neo-Nazis, let alone fascists. I wrote it out at the time. They're described as, these are the different modifiers, partisans, nationalist, an anti-fascist militia, armed group fighting against the Kremlin. And then that was in March 3rd. And I just saw that Ivan Kachinovsky, former Radio Warner guest, pointed out that they did the same thing again with their new article on the new incursion. They call them a group of anti-Kremlin Russian fighters. These are actual neo-Nazis, but they won't even freaking say it. Now imagine if, it's obvious what would happen had the reverse been true. And the fact is the New York Times would report, there was like a 50-50 chance that they would report on these guys, for example, being neo-Nazis or fascist or something far-right extremist. They would use modifiers like that before 2022. And now it's just considered bad form, to do that. Yeah. So they won't. It's frustrating. I know you also wanted to bring up, I think you mentioned it already, but you wanted to bring up sort of the strange press reaction to the fall of Bakhmut.
I wanted to mention that the reason I noticed this is because the mainstream press has been absolutely gung-ho and united in its gung-ho stance for what to us, as you said just a few minutes ago, is a really depressing war.
Yeah.
But for them, it's a delight. It's a chance to deploy all these anti-Soviet and then anti-Russian tropes that they've been saving up for years. And it's sort of kind of the 2 minutes hate, a kind of orgasmic for them. But the one slip that I've seen in what has become a very well-orchestrated media campaign was when the BBC and many other sites said that Bakhmut had fallen, and Meanwhile, Zelensky said, no, it hasn't. Bakhmut hasn't fallen. And that was very odd. That, everything was in harmony in the Western media up to that point, about everything about Ukraine. And here are some of the headlines that I noticed, like a standard one, which is New York Times, is with Bakhmut in ruins, Ukraine shifts focus to cities outskirts, like, you know, we'll fight them in the city center, we'll fight them on the outskirts. And, all. And then the Washington Post, which always goes over the top, Ukraine pushes to surround Bakhmut. Yes. In a new aim of tactical encirclement.
I know, that was one of the weirder ones. It's like, I think a lot of people were mocking that. I saw, like, we're semi-encircling them by losing.
It was a classic. Like, you know, we are purposely letting them in order to draw. And then CNN, which is sort of like the C-minus student in class, said, Ukraine, large areas of Bakhmut's suburbs liberated. And I don't even know what they meant by that.
I know, because at first I'm thinking that's what the Russians would say, right? Prigozhin liberated, in his language, Bakhmut's suburbs, but
they,
I guess—
They can't. They can't.
No, no, no. You know what it is because a week or so, a week, 10 days ago, some Ukrainian forces, some of the more elite forces— did gain some ground, like south of Bakhmut and north of Bakhmut, sort of northwest of Bakhmut and southwest. They had sort of regained a couple square kilometers on in, I guess, what would be suburbs or, you know, village outskirts, but not Bakhmut proper. And so I guess that's what they mean. They're kind of like, let's not talk about this now. Let's talk about what happened a little while ago.
Then the outlier headline, and this was in a lot of sites, but this is one from the BBC. Ukraine war, colon. Bakhmut, quote, not occupied, end quote, by Russia, says defiant Zelensky. Maybe defiant has something about it. Like, you're going to let Zelensky tell something that's clearly a morale-building lie, but you want the audience to know that, you know, it actually was. And then he says again, Al Jazeera, Zelensky says Bakhmut is not occupied. But that was weird because, as I said, all the mainstream news sites said, yes, Bakhmut has fallen. But
well, they equivocated, though. They were sort of more like, Russia says it's fallen. But that's how they do this, you know. And you know, it's—I mean, it's a good question. It depends on what audience you think he's talking to. Mm. I mean, I was thinking about this as well when, because for the first sort of 48 hours or so after Bakhmut did fall, and it was clear they it did, the way the Western media was sort of reporting it was Russia saying this happened. But Zelensky and the Ukrainians say it's not true yet. And but you could kind of tell just by reading between the lines that, you know, even the media people know it's happened, but they're not yet to report it. And I think, look, number one, what's the downside to Zelensky lying? What, he's going to get fact-checked?
Right.
You know, no one's going to fact-check him. No one's going to call him out for lying. Everybody in the media world at least understands this is war, and for morale reasons, he needs to lie. And then for his domestic audience, I mean, you know, Bakhmut holds was this big slogan after Zelensky went there in December and visited the troops and really made it. I mean, even the New York Times wrote about this. Like, he went there and he made Bakhmut holding out kind of a central focus of the war effort, which was probably mistake number one.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it. And, you know, I can understand why he did do it, because at that time it still seemed like Ukraine's military could perform miracles. They were so much more professional, had such a higher morale. The Russians, they were, you know, the Ukrainians, as you do when you've had some victories, any side, they started, that was at the period where they were still mocking how poorly Russians fought, how they were all animals eating, you know, out of trash cans and fighting in human waves and all this crap. Like, they were underestimating what Russia was capable of. You know, just because Russia totally botched the invasion and has not is not like sort of the big giant scary monster that it was made out to be, doesn't mean they can't take Bakhmut, you know, eventually right. after 11 months. It's still a big, powerful country. And Ukraine,
by the way, you can see sort of the next dislocation, the next brain fog, which is, yay, Russia can't even take Bakhmut. However, Russia is still a threat to take Manhattan. It's first we take Bakhmut, or sort of, and then instantly we take Manhattan, because you still need Russia as a scary monster in the long term and on a much bigger scale than this. And apparently it's possible to make people believe that Russia can barely take Bakhmut after more than a year of war, but it is still a threat to Hamburg or, nay, New York.
It's more the sort of the Baltics and the Polish sort of, you know, pundits and politicians who are pushing that line really hard. In fact, I think there was an article recently by some top political figures in one of these Baltic countries. I think it was maybe in Foreign Policy, arguing what you just said, which is sort of, yes, they can't really take Bakhmut, but they are actually a bigger threat to NATO than ever. And don't be, you know, don't be lulled into sleep. And that's what the bear wants you to do, is be lulled into thinking you're safe. You know, we need to raise budgets to 4% of GDP, of defense budgets to 4%. And, you know, we need to station half of America's military in our country now and all this stuff. So, yeah, it does get sort of muddled in that way. I don't see really the downside. And so it helps kind of muddle the morale hit to Ukrainians by kind of, I mean, if you concede when the Russians are gloating, that's a morale hit. That's a double sort of morale hit. Yeah, it's true. You just drag it out. No, they didn't. Then you divert. Oh, look at this invasion by the Russian Volunteer Corps into Russia. Mm. Like, you know, it's still going to hurt a lot. It's going to create problems, that they're going to have to do something bigger, but at least you've blunted it a little bit, and there is zero downside. I mean, some people may start trusting them less. I don't know. I mean, I was listening on BBC to, it was either Zelensky or Podolyak or somebody high up in the government telling them, if you remember when the drones attacked the Kremlin just before the May 9th victory parade, right?
Uh-huh.
And they were saying with a straight face, and the BBC was giving it equal airing. They were saying with a straight face, this wasn't Ukraine. This had nothing to do with us. This was a false flag by Putin to ramp up war fever and consolidate power, some bullshit like that. And the Kagan's, you know, Institute for the Study of War think tank, which all the journalists like live by, like the Bible, said the same thing. Oh yeah, this is clearly has all the hallmarks of a false flag. Putin did this to consolidate support for the war. Like, what are you talking about? You
know, it's just I'm sure the Reichstag was mentioned yet again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean,
the Reichstag has burned so many times in the past few years.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, I don't think he burned the Reichstag in 1943 to get support for the war in 1942. No. You know, like, this is already mid-war. What the hell? You know, it's ridiculous. And you know, honest people who are pro-Ukraine admit, yeah, obviously it's ridiculous. I mean, Putin, all that does is make the Kremlin look weak. I mean, what Putin did was pretend to ignore it and say it was nothing. You know, anyway, by now we know that was obvious BS. So, you know, it's sort of like with the fascists and ignoring the fascists. It's just everybody knows who's the good guys. I mean, everybody who matters in this country knows who's the good guys and who's the bad guys and what to say and what not to say.
Well, let's go on to something more cheerful, which
please,
which is the disappearance of 30 tons of explosives.
Yes.
On an American railway trip. I love this story. This is from May 16th, like about a week ago. And I have to read the beginning. Some 60,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate, a chemical used as both fertilizer and a component in explosives, went missing as it was shipped by rail from Wyoming to California. That's quite an opening, you know? You can't top that easily.
I love that the car was found to be empty after it had arrived 2 weeks later at a rail stop in the Mojave. Well, Jeb, where's the 60,000 pounds of ammonia nitrate? That could blow up a city. Golly, I don't know. I thought you had it.
Yeah, I can just imagine some latter-day Johnny Appleseed with a big sack walking down the track from Cheyenne, Wyoming to California, picking up little pellets of ammonium nitrate, humming as he goes. And then when you ask him what he's going to do with them, he just sort of grins and winks at you. And it's a fine new American folk tradition. But yeah, 60,000 pounds, 30 tons of this stuff is missing. And this story, as far as I know, didn't really hit big. It was just, oh, yeah, it's missing. Yeah, all that 60 tons of high explosives. The car was found to be empty. It's like the kind of passives you teach your students not to do. who emptied the car, guys?
I know.
It was found, at a rail stop in the Mojave Desert, and suddenly there was nothing in it. The company, Dyno Nobel, I mean, like Nobel as in the prize or the dynamite, made the report to the Federal National Response Center. The initial assessment is that a leak through the bottom gate on the rail car may have developed in transit. Mm. Okay.
60,000 pounds.
60,000 pounds just sort of leaked out.
Yeah. No one, how could
and
they possibly
this is know? The stuff that made the Oklahoma City bomb back in the 90s. And I mean, you do need a detonator with that stuff, but that's all you need. And if you can get one detonator, you can pack a lot of ammonium nitrate around it and it will explode in a very big way, like enough to destroy a massive building, which includes a daycare center. So, who knows? Who knows if we've even seen the last of that? Like, and speaking of Nazis, recently another story popped up that would dovetail with this one very nicely. U-Haul truck with Nazi flags crashes into barricades near White House.
So he only had Nazi flags in the U-Haul? That's
apparently. Yeah,
that is really weird. I'm going to rent a truck and put in a Nazi flag. That'll show him. It has magical powers, flag.
It really does seem like those movies where the Nazis invoke dark powers and that's all they need. No, you actually need, the explosives, which the Oklahoma City guy, whose name I would normally remember. But
Timothy McVeigh.
Which he knew. God, this is a scary symptom. I swear,
that is pretty weird. I know.
Yeah. That guy, whoever was driving that truck, just got whisked away by the Capitol Police. Not identified, not anything. Just a big old swastika flag lying on the ground, and one of those classic U-Haul trucks that are perfect for fertilizer bombs, abandoned at the gate. So, you know, it's kind of like watch this space.
Yeah.
I imagine that something will turn up with that 60,000 pounds.
Well, I got to say, man, thinking about, the East Palestine train, that huge like chemical explosion and all that, which is a story that it was very weirdly misreported in the mainstream media.
Oh, absolutely. Because you cannot make Biden look bad in the papers of record, and it made him look very bad. He didn't even visit this place. How much would that have cost?
Or Buttigieg. You can't make Buttigieg look bad because the media people love Buttigieg, and he's
the
transportation secretary.
But anyway,
he talks like them. He's the kind of guy that they they went to grad school with or something. Ugh. Really. Yeah. Or prep school with, you know. They talk alike. They love them. But again, like watching all that, wouldn't you, if you had, and I'm not advocating this, but if you had malevolent intent, if you were from a foreign group with malevolent intent or a domestic group, wouldn't you be watching all this train stuff? I mean, wouldn't you just put Google alerts, trains, you know?
Yep.
And you would be seeing all this and you would think, you know, you can rustle this stuff. This stuff spills off it with its eyes closed. I mean, it's a bounty for anybody who would.
In fact, railroads in general, because they are a triumph of cost cutting and lobbying, and nobody pays any attention to them.
Exactly.
And they can leak toxic stuff all over.
Yeah.
And basically, they run through communities that the elite doesn't care about anyway. You can do a lot with something like that. One of the parallels that's kind of interesting is from the spy wars of the NATO versus Warsaw Pact thing. Russian Soviet defectors tended to be middle-high rank. And because, you know, they had a ceiling over their heads and it irked them. They wanted to be in a bigger, freer place to have a bigger life. But on the other side, it was very often janitors who leaked NATO secrets, sometimes for money, sometimes for honey trap, sometimes for ideological reasons, sort of Lee Harvey Oswald types. They were the ones who were considered lowly enough that nobody paid any attention to them.
Right.
You know, they were just contemptuous office furniture. And they leaked an awful lot of stuff. So, yeah, if you drop below the attention of the American elite, you're a very fruitful field for espionage or sabotage.
That reminds me, this is a slight change of subject, but back to the Civil War reenactment. There's this one, this one's African-American guy who just really knew his logistics well. He was in this one area of the museum. And he was talking about how one of the big problems for the Confederates was that they, like every railroad had its own gauge. So, you know, obviously we know that they didn't have railroads nearly as well developed as the North, but they did have railroads and they had money. But it was such a like libertarian dystopia with every rail, you know, God forbid any regulator should tell any private railroad tycoon what gauge to have their trains in. So every time they'd have to move anything anywhere, you'd have to get off the train, stop and get off and get on another train, you know, 50 times before you got to your end point because of all the different gauges in the trains.
Of those Southern railroads were amazing. One of the reasons it was pretty easy for Union troops to wreck them, to make Sherman's neckties out of them, is that if you see some of the rails, you think of modern rails, and they're sort of like shaped like a capital T, and they're massive. But some of these railroads from the private Southern companies were sort of like an Iron Age sword, you know, just a little strip of metal that you could pretty easily wind around a tree.
Let's go on some other sort of cheerful news. Sinn Féin's sweep in Northern Ireland. I was looking at a graph of Sinn Féin's, the growth in their sort of electoral successes from, I don't know, the 90s or maybe even 80s. And it's just, the trend line is just up, 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 you know, with sort of ups and downs in the middle, but just up, up, up. And now they're the largest party. These were local elections. Am I right? And these were,
local elections, but massive elections.
Yes.
And the way you can tell how shocking the Sinn Féin sweep was is that there's basically been a complete shutdown on news in most of the British media. They reported it grudgingly, but then they largely stopped reporting it at all. If you go to the BBC now, you'll have quite a hard time finding stories on Sinn Féin, in spite of the fact that this was a stunning election, massive victory, and Sinn Féin is now the largest party in Ireland, both sides of the border. Brexit is part of that. The astonishing stubborn stupidity, let's say, of the DUP is part of that too. But something else is part of it, that they actually have the activists and they have the policies and they've got a 21st century sort of ideology that was, at the time it was initiated by Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, very unpopular within the party. I was reading all this stuff back then, so I remember this. Like, Sinn Féin was going to become a gay-friendly party, for one thing. It was going to endorse any social change that didn't come at the expense of anybody else. It was going to clamp down really hard on any immigrant bashing. And that cost them really quite a lot at the time. But it's paid off. And its rival, the DUP, is still, well, you know, there are not a lot of young people in the DUP. And those who are in the DUP just don't get it. They refuse to participate in an electoral process they consider immoral for God knows what reasons, stretching literally back to the dinosaurs. So Sinn Féin has absorbed a lot of immigrant population in its ranks. And for an Irish nationalist party, which is still caricatured by the Dublin media as, you know, sort of red-faced, shouting, nativist stuff, that's pretty amazing. And the Dublin reaction, I thought, was particularly hilarious. The Irish Times, which is sort of a good index of anti-nationalist Dublin sensibility, tried to ignore the election as much as possible. And when they did deal with it, it was under this headline: "We held off a machine. Sinn Féin is a machine. Smaller parties regroup after Northern Ireland elections." So what they did was focus on this failed party in its defeat. And the story begins: "Walking out of the back gates of a stifling Belfast City Hall at tea time on Sunday evening, the Green Party's Brian Smith looks anxious. 'We've a long night to go. We're all a bit sore, but we're still standing. We held off a machine. Sinn Féin is a machine.'" So this is a party that lost, that actually lost big. But the Irish Times, because it has an extraordinary phobia, partly born out of bad conscience, about Sinn Féin, and they just can't deal with it. So they chose to do a deep dive into this interview with this guy from one of the losing parties instead of talk to somebody from the winning party.
Yeah, or the supporters of the winning party to find out why they won. You know, it's... they almost make it seem like this is sort of one step away from calling Sinn Féin the elites, you know.
Which would be a new one, definitely. I know, huh?
But they're close. But no, I mean, and also Sinn Féin is just hugely benefiting from the whole Brexit disaster, right? Because Sinn Féin's principled policy all along, which is uniting with Ireland, now looks, whereas before, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you could have said, well, that means uniting with this poor backwards, you know, maybe 30 years ago. Now it's you're uniting with the EU and getting rid of this, you know, albatross, which is dying England. So it's super progressive in that way. And
the reaction to the from the main press, mainstream press, is extraordinary. The only thing is, I don't think the mainstream press matters that much anymore. Sinn Féin has grown up in its latest incarnation as a party that was not just disliked, but viscerally hated by every media within the British Isles, and every medium, all the media, let's say, within the British Isles. And they've found a way to adapt to that. In fact, that's now that the media has acquired a kind of distasteful aura, that's helping them.
Yeah, so, yep, that would. And also, I think having Gerry Adams kind of stepping aside. Yeah. I mean, they're led by, Sinn Féin are led by two women, Mary Lou McDonald and Michelle O'Neill. And Gerry Adams is sort of, he stepped aside, but he's still kind of makes appearances and makes jokes on Twitter and stuff, I think, you know, did for a while anyway.
Bad jokes. Not
I know. Dad jokes. Chummy. Yeah, dad jokes. Exactly. Yeah. But that's good news. I mean, they're on their way. They could be, they could take both. I just have a question. So if they control both Northern Ireland's politics and then Ireland proper's politics, if they are allowed to, you know, rule, is the policy then to do referendums on uniting?
Is that sort of the goal? There has to be a referendum, at least in Northern Ireland. There would really have to be, I suppose, referenda both sides of the border. And I don't think there would be any great hurry to do that, really. I think the effects of Brexit need to accumulate to the point that it becomes obvious to everybody who, you know, isn't a 90-year-old Free Presbyterian Church member that this is ridiculous and that you're stuck with a bad deal by a UK polity that doesn't really care much about you.
Yeah. You're still having that B12 injection kind of coursing around, fixing up little cells all around you. So I don't want to keep you too long. I guess just a 2 minutes on the Turkish elections. If that's all right.
Basically it's another weird media story. The Turkish elections were a big story until they happened. And then, possibly because they're in two stages, at least this time, there's not much about them. If you can, get a map of party victory by district in Turkey, because it's really illuminating and it really shows why we've often said that Turkey's one of the few polities that it's really tempting to compare with the United States, because there's a big right-wing middle. Most of Asia Minor is the middle, and it votes heavily for Erdogan. They thought maybe it wouldn't vote for him anymore because the government, his government, messed up the response to the earthquakes in the south and west. But no, this loyalty is really, really deep. It would be like Kansas not going Republican. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So what happens is there's an opposition victory in the southeastern corner of Turkey, which is basically the Kurdish part, in one little district, basically Dersim, which was the home of Alevi Kurds who were massacred by the Kemalist government in the 1930s, one little holdout in a sea of yellow, which is usually used to represent Erdogan's party. And then the coast, which, like Smyrna, now Izmir, These are places that were inhabited by Greek and other Armenian, other minority people who are officially Turkish now because it was be Turkish or die, which many of them did. Mm. But there's still a kind of sense that we don't really want to be kind of angry Hicks. We were more cosmopolitan people, and we don't want to vote for you. But there are enough of sort of the Turkish red state voters to provide Erdogan with a lead over his opponents, who are basically Kemalists anyway. They're not saints either. And there's a third candidate who has now, just today, said, anybody who wants to vote for me in the runoff, vote for Erdogan. So it's pretty clear that Erdogan is going to win this election, but at least it was closer than any others have been.
The third candidate from the more overtly fascist party, right?
Yeah, pretty darn fascist, yeah.
Aliyev, the dictator of Azerbaijan, took credit for that. He said, I talked to him and I told him, you should support Erdogan, and he supported Erdogan. And this is paying back a favor that I got from Erdogan. It's just lovely people all around. But I was listening to some podcast, I think it was like, what's it called? War on the Rocks. You know, where, like, their biases, you know them, it's very pro-US, pro-NATO, but not the worst of that field. And they had on two sort of Turkey experts. One was a Turkish woman who's a journalist, and another was an American who was sort of an expert in the area. And the Turkish woman was saying, she was like, you know, I'm so mad at, it was really interesting listening to it because it sounded very familiar. And she said, I should have known that Erdogan would have won, and I missed it. But I didn't pay attention to even all of the signs that I saw personally in my life of all the people who I knew personally and had talked to who were basically nationalists. And they're saying, yes, I know Erdogan did this and that and the other, but I'm still going to vote for him. But my bias, she said, you know, basically my bias is for not wanting him to win, and sort of the polls that were coming out showing that Erdogan was going to lose kind of just made me, had the effect of essentially making me ignore that to a degree and not listening to what I actually knew in front of me. And she just kept emphasizing how annoyed she was with herself for not paying attention to this.
Turkish intellectuals have a lot of rigor. I mean, if she was an American intellectual from Manhattan, she would just have said, you know, it can't be. It has to be a Russian conspiracy that Hillary didn't win. But at least she does acknowledge that. And there is this sense that there's the massive angry people in the center of the country that is not well understood by the people who talk for a living, and they vote, though, and their votes count. I mean, Erdogan may be a mess in all kinds of ways, and he's getting to be more and more of a mess, but there's that overwhelming sense of a kind of vengeful nationalism that came out of the early 20th century, and the fact that there's been a century of fascist propaganda in Turkey, and it is fascist propaganda. I mean, for God's sake, the dominant party, its emblem is six arrows. Very, very early 30s graphics.
It was fasci, someone might call them.
Turkey was supposed to be a mono-ethnic state, which it never was. And they hammered that into people and made them believe that the alternative was chaos, and it works.
Yeah. I mean, even the opposition guy is essentially Kemalist, as you said. Kelich Dairolu, I guess his name is. And yeah, I mean, he even started really upping the xenophobia, which is a little strange. But I guess, you know, he's Alevi, right? Or part Alevi. So he might have to be more Turkish than the Turks to.
Probably. There's a lot of that.
Or was told that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I guess we had to end off with a more depressing story.
Yeah, it's a tradition. You
know. Yeah, it is. So I think we can leave it there. Thanks for, John, for sticking it out. You know, wounded in action. You know, you got your shot before the show. And you held out. And I hope you're feeling better over the next few days.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.